Hello and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Aurel Croissant, a professor who studies Southeast Asia. We talk about his new book on the history of Southeast Asian militaries from colonial times to present day and their relationship with civilian leadership in those countries. Well, thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Professor Aurel Croissant, author of Civil-Military Relations in Southeast Asia. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
Well, I come from democratization studies. So originally, I studied processes of transition from authoritarianism to democracy in Asia. And during my time at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, I got in contact with people who are doing military studies. And during my own studies and conversations with these colleagues, I realized that civil-military relations in the region of Southeast Asia is probably one of the most important, if not the most important, aspect of regime change and how democracies consolidate or fail. So that's how I got into the topic of civil-military relations.
Okay. Now, do you focus on each country in Southeast Asia equally, or how do you break it out in the book?
Yeah, usually I focus more on the larger countries. That includes the Philippines, of course, Indonesia, Thailand, so the so-called young or new democracies, but also on Malaysia, Singapore, and Vietnam as contrasting examples, and Myanmar, of course. Mm-hmm. And these three countries or three groups of countries also represent something like different patterns of civil-military relations.
Mm-hmm. And in the description, it says the books go back to colonial times. So tell me, how do you break out what time periods you focus on throughout the book?
Okay, the book makes the core argument that the development of civil-military relations is past-dependent. That means that the early origins of civil-military relations, the type of interaction between non-military elites and military elites, has a strong impact on the development of civil-military relations after independence and also across regime changes. So what I'm looking at in this book is, first of all, what type of military organizations emerged in the during the late colonial time and during the period of struggle for independence, and how the types of military organizations that evolved in these early stages of civil-military relations have then developed during the post-colonial time and in case of Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, and also East Timor after the transition to democracy. So the main argument is a historical argument and an argument of past-dependent development of institutions.
Now, how much do you find that these various militaries have embraced and drawn from what they learned maybe under colonial control versus how much is more indigenous to the area?
Well, as always, it's a mix of both. The interesting thing is that in all Southeast Asian countries, even those who gained independence through armed revolutionary struggle, military institutions, military organizations were modeled after non-Southeast Asian, that is more or less Western models. There are basically two models. One is the Western model, the British or American or French model, and the other model is the communist model, basically Soviet Union and China. And these two different models were very influential, very powerful in shaping the form of military organization in all Southeast Asian countries. There is an indigenous element to it, of course. And the most important indigenous ingredients to civil-military relations is, of course, the strong economic role and role of the military in social and economic development. That's not a persistent element of all civil-military relations, but it is something that is unique to Southeast Asia.
So That sort of segues into a question I had, which is how much are these militaries historically, have they depended, once they achieved independence, how much did they depend on foreign countries to supply them with the military arms they needed, and how did that affect things?
Yeah. Well, in most countries, they depended to some extent on military equipment, hardware that they gained from other countries, either Soviet Union and China, with respect to the socialist armies, or military hardware and also support in form of alliance structures and military training from Western countries, most importantly or almost exclusively Great Britain and, of course, the United States of America. So we have two different groups of armies and regimes, those anti-communist regimes and anti-communist armies that relied more or less heavily, depends on the country, on external support from the United States and Great Britain, and those who were dependent on support from China and the Soviet Union. The case of Myanmar is to some extent exceptional because of the autarky policy that the military junta, military government after 1962 implemented. So the case of Myanmar is somewhat of a deviant case.
Now, of the countries that are receiving aid from the two different sort of political camps, how much did they have to conform politically to these external powers? You know, how much independence did they have, or did they choose to be? What was that interplay?
On the one hand, I mean, again, we talk more about groups of countries rather than all of Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, with Cambodia dependent on Vietnam after 1978, these armies were under the authority of the Communist Party. So the question how much independence did these armies have or militaries have vis-a-vis their external sponsors is more a question of how much autonomy, how much independence did the party enjoy. When it comes to the non-communist regimes like Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and so on, I would say that in all these countries, in the countries where the military had independence or autonomy from the government or was the government, as it was often the case in Thailand, these armies had a considerable degree of autonomy or independence from their Western sponsors. So it was pretty much only, I would say, in South Vietnam and in Cambodia until 1975 that one could really say, because they were dependent on economic support and military support from an external sponsor, they were also politically dependent. So overall, I would say, despite the fact that they relied on external support, they still had a considerable degree, enjoyed a considerable degree of political independence. But some of these armies are under civilian control, exercised by a ruling party like in Malaysia or Singapore.
Now, what about the strategy, the military strategy of these countries? Mm-hmm. Were they basically used to extend the strategic goals of their external supporters, or did they have their own concerns within the region?
Most of them had their own and still have their own concerns in the region. Though this this idea that they serve in strategic purpose of an external power only applies to South Vietnam and in historical perspective and regarding with respect to the current situation, that applies only to South Vietnam and and Cambodia before 75. All of these armies and their civilian leader, they have their own strategic goals, which may or may not be in alliance with external powers.
In these various countries, how much, we are focused on their militaries, but
yes,
how much, considering the civilian control, how much is the military a part of these, the society of these various countries you look at?
Yeah, okay. I would say in most countries, except some cases, few cases like Brunei, for example, in most countries, the military has a very prominent and important role in society and politics. Often the military envisioned itself and is still perceiving itself as the guardian of the nation and something like the role model for social development and national development in these countries. There are some differences when it comes to the question of who is the guardian or who is the principal and who is the agent. So in countries like Malaysia and Singapore, the army is deeply entrenched, is well integrated in the economic, political, and sometimes also the social structure of these countries. But it accepts the primacy, supremacy of the ruling party. In other countries like Myanmar, of course, but also Thailand and until very recently Indonesia, the military saw itself above, as standing above the society, so guiding the society and being something like the reference institution for the society.
So looking back in history at colonial times, was did these countries have as strong a military presence then that sort of they kept that culturally, or has it changed over time to what it is?
I think it has more to do with the period of anti-colonial struggle and independence. So in countries like Indonesia, Myanmar, and to some extent in Thailand, the military saw itself as the single most important institution or organization in the struggle for independence. Thailand, of course, was never colonized, but still the military saw itself as the standard bearer of creating a modern Thailand after the Constitutional Revolution in 1932. So it was not so much the colonial period itself where military organizations emerged, but then did not survive as an institution during the period or process of decolonization. But it's especially the mix of colonial legacies and the role that the military played in the struggle for national sovereignty that shaped civil-military relations and the self-perception, self-identity, corporate culture of the military. And there, really, the important thing is, or the important factor is, what was the role of the military during processes of transition from colonial to independence, colonial rule to independence?
Did the of the various militaries that you studied, did you see a strong division between services like you see in the West, you know, Army, Air Force?
I see the point, the interesting thing is that all Southeast Asian armies, with a possible exception of Singapore, the Singapore Armed Forces, all these armed forces, military organizations, are army-dominated. That is, they all have their different branches, but the army, both in terms of manpower, equipment, share of defense budget, as well as in terms of political clout, these armed forces are army-dominated armed forces. They have navies, of course, they have air forces, of course, but those are fairly small compared to the army branch, and even countries like Singapore, like the Philippines and Indonesia, which are basically island states with 7,000, 10,000 islands, even in these two countries, the army is the dominant branch. So there have been conflicts between different branches, like in Thailand in the 1940s and 50s, sometimes even including the police force. But for the past 50, 60 years, the Southeast Asian armed forces have been army dominated, both in military terms and in political terms.
So let me turn towards the resources you used. What did you use for the research in this book?
I used, first of all, original documents, primary documents, mostly government statistics, government reports. I tried to rely, when I used national sources, I tried to rely on sources that are available in English, so to make it available for the reader who does not speak Thai or cannot read Indonesian, Bahasa Indonesia. I relied on interviews, and I relied, of course, on the scholarly literature. So primary documents, secondary documents, and interviews.
So did you were you able to get a lot of this online or over the phone, or did you travel to any of these places?
This book constitutes something like the accumulation of my previous 15 years of research efforts. So the interviews I did for that book, or that went into that book, had been conducted in the past 10 to 15 years, not specifically for the purpose of this book, but for the purpose of my research on civil-military relations.
Mm-hmm. So what part of the research have you found most enjoyable, considering it's covered such so many years?
Most enjoyable was digging into the historical stuff and the research that had been done 50, 60, 70 years ago sometimes. So that was really interesting to see how scholars back in the 1950s, 1960s saw civil-military relations and described them at that point of time. And also the field research in countries like Thailand that was significantly before, the years before the last coup, though that had been in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. But also the interviews in the Philippines, that was really interesting.
So considering all these countries you research, what languages do you know?
Do you mean what languages I speak and can read?
Yes, for this.
Yeah, okay. Well, English, Thai, with the help of my wife, who is Thai. She helps me to translate stuff. And I'm also able to understand at least Indonesian, Bahasa Indonesia.
Okay.
I'm not able to write a book in Bahasa Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
The most surprising thing I find is how much continuity is in civil-military relations from the 19, or has been in civil-military relations from the 1950s until the early or 2000s, or let's say 2010, 2015. So the weight of history is really interesting, how much these institutions stick. How difficult it is also to change institutions or structures of civil-military relations. That was the most interesting scholarly finding. Another finding which I found quite interesting and surprising is how little we really know about the size, composition, and development of these military businesses. Industrial sectors. That's so important in many countries, but it's severely understudied.
So that makes me wonder and ask, considering these many decades of you said there's continuity, but some change, you have coups,
yes,
and such.
Sure.
Are there still people behind the scenes, powerful business interests that, despite any changes, are still in control? You know.
Well, it's difficult to say if and who are these powerful actors, individuals, elite groups, social classes, and it's also difficult to say they are in control. I think the the reality is more complex. It's not, in most cases, it's not that there is a single group of economic actors, businessmen, or the economic elite, or there's a small group of military elites that are in control of the political system. It's often more a system of negotiation and bargaining between different elite groups who have overlapping, who may have overlapping interests, or whose interests are sometimes, who are also sometimes competing, and there's a conflict of interests between, or conflicting interests between these different groups. So it's not that there is a single group who controls and calls the shots, but it's a complex system. Even in authoritarian regimes like Vietnam or Laos, and Laos is obviously a system which is particularly opaque, it's more a give and take, negotiation, competition, contestation, bargaining between different groups.
Was there an issue, or has there been an issue that's been particularly difficult for you to come to a conclusion on, maybe you still wonder about?
Yeah, what I think really deserves further investigation, examination is, first of all, I find in my book that the role of the military in politics in Southeast Asia depends to a large extent on the strength of non-military civilian institutions, especially political parties. And I still have problems to explain why strong political parties emerge in some countries but not in others, and especially why they survive over time or fail. So my argument is a historical argument, and it has to do with the role of the military during the colonial and especially the independence period, early independence period. A second argument is that the strength of civilian institutions is important to explain, in order to explain the strength of political strength of military institutions. But, of course, if you make the argument the stronger political institutions, the less powerful is the military, then you have to explain the strength of civilian institutions, especially political parties. And this is something which I did not investigate in my book, and I think we still need to do more research on the reasons for strong or weak political civilian political institutions.
Was there anything you discovered that had an emotional impact on you, either positively or negatively?
No, not really.
No, it's...
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Sorry. No, I mean, this is not a... I must confess, this is not a book about individuals, for example. It's not a book about tragedies and triumphs. Mm-hmm. It's an academic book that tries to make sense of a certain... to explain a certain puzzle.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the book will do?
I hope the book will help those who want to reform civil-military relations in order to not only strengthen accountability of the military, political accountability, but also to increase their effectiveness. After all, societies create military institutions because they want the military to fulfill a certain purpose of function, and that is providing security for individuals and society, that those who want to reform civil-military relations in Southeast Asia develop a better understanding about the difficulties of changing institutions of civil-military relations, also develop a better understanding for the time constraints or the long time that such reforms take. And understand that reforming civil-military relations in order to increase accountability or control and effectiveness is not something that you can achieve overnight or within 2, 3, or 5 years, but this is a long-term process.
Okay. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in finishing or publishing the book and how you overcame those?
Oh, well, the most important difficulty was there were a number of difficulties. Number one is, as I already mentioned, I realized, unsurprisingly, that military industrial sectors or complex is very important, but it's extremely difficult to research. it's challenging. Second is, so I realized in the book that's important, but I also realized that we probably have still to do more research on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a limitation of what I, or constraint or limitation of what I could achieve. Second is, well, as many of my colleagues could testify, this book has about 35,000 words, though it's a rather short book. And my first manuscript, which I tried to submit to the publisher, had about 70,000 words. So I had to cut half of it out of the manuscript. I had to trim the manuscript by about 50%. So that was another challenge, to bring it really to make it concise and crispy.
Mm-hmm. What's your next writing project?
Oh, well, actually, my next project, or my current project, I have two projects which are related to this one. I'm writing together with a colleague, friend of mine. I'm writing a book about civilian control and democracy during the so-called third wave of democratization. That's a global comparison of the development of civil-military relations in those countries that have attempted or tried to transition from dictatorship to democracy after or since 1974. So that's a global comparison. Mm-hmm. And the main question is, why do some countries succeed and others fail? Mm-hmm. So I'm writing this book right now. And the other project has also to do with or is related to civil-military relations in Southeast Asia. That's an edited volume I'm doing with a colleague from Naval Postgraduate School on the relationship between civilian control and military effectiveness, how the two are related, and what are the trade-offs between civilian control and military effectiveness. Because the literature, most scholars tend to argue that political control of the military is a necessary precondition for military effectiveness. That is, how good is the military at achieving its politically defined missions and roles and goals?
Mm-hmm.
While in that project, we argue that there might be a trade-off between too much control and military effectiveness.
So where can people find the book, and where can they follow you online or social media?
Oh, well, the book, the people can find the book at Cambridge University Press online at the catalog, or they can just email me, and I'm at the moment the ebook is free of charge.
Hmm.
So they can download it, and they can find me at my website, Heidelberg University, and they can just email me.
Okay.
So I'm not following Twitter. I'm very old school. I'm not on Twitter. Sorry.
That's fine. That's all the questions I have. Any final thoughts or words?
Oh, well, thank you very much for your interest in the book. I hope people will find it helpful and will enjoy it. And I hope I receive a lot of questions and feedback.
Okay. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.